Hey everyone, Coach Dave here. Just want to thank you again for listening. And just wanted to remind you that, as always, we are a coaching company. So if you are looking to get coached for the fall or upcoming 2024 season, or if you're looking for a consult for somebody to take a look at your data and look for areas of improvement, or if you're local in the Boulder / Colorado area and looking for one-on-one skills, we are accepting new athletes. So you can reach us at KaizenEndurance.coach. Again, that's KaizenEndurance.coach. And without further ado, this week's podcast. Thanks for listening. Hey, welcome back. This is the Training Babble Podcast, and I'm your host, Dave Schell. And today we're joined again by the gravel god, Matty Rowe. Matty, thanks for taking the time today.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
So last time you and I talked, I think we had, I can't even recall, but last time it was just kind of a hodgepodge talking about peeing off the bike and some of the things beyond fitness that you could do to gain time in gravel races or just races in general. One of the things that came up was skills. And so you and I had talked about working on some skills off the bike or on the bike rather, to help with some of the things you were struggling with in races. And so you and I met, some of the things we worked on and remind me if I'm missing any of them, but for me, the big things are weight management, vision, and then the attacker kind of ready position. And so you and I went and rode around the local Boulder trails and Longmont trails and kind of worked on those things. So keeping those things in mind, like what were some of the things that really resonated with you and that like clicked when we were working on it? And one example I have specifically is we were descending down some washboard and I was talking about like getting off the saddle and just like kind of using your knees as shock absorbers. And that kind of blew your mind that like, oh, I don't have to be bucked off the saddle every time I'm going downhill. I can actually like absorb some of this chatter.
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up first, because to me, everything needs to be boiled down into mantras, because when you're surrounded by people and going really fast and it's crazy, you don't have time to like think through a 20 bullet point paragraph in your head of cues. You need like a mantra. And so for me, I just think like weight to feet. And that's the biggest separator I see between people who really struggle with washboards or just general technicality, is you can tell that their weight isn't through their feet, their hands aren't loose, and they're sort of connected to their bike. And that is like, if you're going to do one thing, it should be that. Because it just changes everything. The bike does so much for you, like just like gets through so much BS without you really having to do that much. If you just put all of your weight through your feet, keep loose hands and kind of get your ass back a little bit. That's like a night and day type move to me. The vision thing I sort of knew a bit before, but there are two other things that you said that have really connected with me. And you didn't put it this way, but you had drawn me this little diagram and sent it to me, and you were emphasizing the front wheel. And now what I think when I'm descending or navigating technical stuff is my front wheel is my lover and I need to protect it. That just means that you don't, under no circumstances do you panic lever your front wheel or do anything crazy with your front wheel when you're going fast or turning or whatever else. You protect it. You keep it away from other people. You don't ask it to do anything insane through a turn. You have to watch that. And so just those two cues alone, the weight and your front wheel is your lover and you need to protect it, make a huge difference. Like that has taken me from absolutely abysmal whenever the road goes downhill to at least like average, like I'll call it B-, just that alone. And then another thing that you said that we sort of did on this little, it was a little switchback. Remember that little switchback? Yeah. So you were saying when we were going down, like, hey, like notice how it's like pretty loose heading into the turn, but right before the turn, there was this, hard packed gravel. And you said, yeah, so you can like let your speed go and you can be pretty wild. And the moment you see surface that is packed, that's when you can like, if you need to scrub speed, scrub it there because you have great purchase. Exactly. And you can get just that much you need to then like make the turn more manageable for you. And man, so whenever I'm descending now, I do those two other cues or anything technical, think those two other mantras, but I'm also always looking for like, okay, where is some bare hard pack? And usually you can almost guarantee there's some. It's rare that there's not. And then you can take speed that other people, you can tell it's like, even people around you, they're like, whoa, he's going really fast. And you think to yourself, shit, I am going really fast. But then you get to that spot and you scrub and it's fine. And then even if it's a little loose to the turn or whatever, you're fine. But like before, I was never looking for that. I would just see like loose and I was like, parachute.
Right.
Now it's like, oh no, you can ball pretty hard as long as there's that like safety patch that you can then use to scrub speed. And so those three things have elevated me from absolute F to solid B minus.
And so just to kind of reiterate or expand a little bit on these, when I talk about weight management, that was a big thing we talked about, and always thinking about where your center of mass is in relation to your bottom bracket, with the point being is that if your center of mass is over or behind your bottom bracket, then you're going to be safe. If something happens, if you hit something, things like that, then the weight's behind it and it's not going to send you over the bars or whatever. And, or when you're coming through a corner, you want to be on the inside of it versus the outside so that the wheels can slide a little bit. And when they catch, you're pushing into the turn and not being flipped off to the outside from centrifugal force. Right. The other thing is like you were talking about, it's putting like heavy feet, putting your weight into the pedals and just like really like getting a lot of weight on that back wheel. And then managing the weight of the front wheel where it's like light hands. We kind of like one thing we practiced was just like going down the hill with no hands on washboard. Right. And just watching the front wheel go crazy. And so it's like, you're just there to guide the front wheel, but not take all the chatter through your arms and shoulders, which you had mentioned when we were talking about that, just how fatigued and destroyed your shoulders would be at the end of a gravel race. Right. And so just always thinking about that. And like you said, letting the bike move underneath you and being kind of dynamic versus just this like lump of weight that's sitting on it. The other thing you just mentioned is the front wheel. And that's a huge thing. Like the thing that I tell athletes a lot of times is that like the front wheel is for turning and the back wheel is for propulsion. And as long as the front wheel is turning freely and has purchase, who gives a shit what the back wheel is doing? It can be sliding all over the place and you're going to be fine. One thing that really helped me, I had a downhill coach tell me that he thinks of it as like riding a unicycle. And so as long as the front wheel's good, who cares? And so I, like you said, I'm just always looking where is a good place to put my front wheel, you know? So as you're going down that, like we were talking about that switchback that's really loose and stuff like that, just always looking like where can I kind of like nestle in the front wheel that it's going to have good purchase through the turn. And if that's good, then I'm going to be good. So I think the next race you did after you and I met was Gila. And I think you had sent me a text or something saying that it helped your descending immensely. Will you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's so Gila is a road race, not off-road. So a little bit different, but it's a very competitive, like big field. So like there's two stages in particular, which I would say are probably some of the hardest descents left in domestic road racing. Like one is the Pinos Altos stage, which is, if you're familiar with any front range climbs, it's pretty much like going down like almost like a kind of a hybrid between Flagstaff and Magnolia in the front range, like very, very sustained. I think it's like 3 or 4 miles or something, very tight corners and deceptive corners. Like it's not enough to just like nail the apex on a turn, because sometimes like it just keeps going. And I'm familiar with it because I've done it several times, but yeah, it's a little tricky. And then the last one is the Gila Monster stage, and that features very fast, sustained descents. And the thing about it is, it really highlights, which I think a lot of maybe intermediate to beginner cyclists don't understand as much about, like, the technical demands of racing. It's like at the higher up you get, I would say the more that matters, and you can be fit enough to crest with the climb. But if your descending skills suck and then the pack gaps you off on that climb, you might get back in, but suddenly you have to, like, burn your matchbook, essentially, like, use energy that you would have used to try to stay with the leaders on the next climb, just like getting back on. And I saw this with lots of people in the race who were behind me, because after the lesson we took, the win for me is that I did not get dropped on the climb or on the descent.
Right.
Like, I was at the back because I'm still don't have the nerves to, like, be 20 wheels deep going 40 miles an hour on average through, like, chicanes in a 100-person field. But I was at the back and I stayed in. And every year before, I had gotten dropped on the descent, which really sucks, because then what could have been a resting moment in some sense. And then, you know, you, like, come out of the descent and then the group kind of hangs out, but you're still moving at the speed of the peloton. Instead, I had found myself a couple football fields behind and then had to work hard pretty much at max for 5 to 10 minutes to get back on.
Yeah.
By which point the pack is already starting to go over other challenging terrain and go harder. And so it was just like, I'm maxing myself out for no reason. I'm attacking from behind and getting nowhere. And this was like, it was so different, because I was just in there and I was like, oh, this is easy. I can chill. as opposed to panic and just like burning so many matches and finally getting on. And then, yeah.
I think that's such a good point. And I think a lot of people, or maybe they don't, but I think people, because of our emphasis on power numbers and FTP and all these other things, that, like, everybody, like, that's always a focus, right? And, like, you get done with a race and a lot of times people are looking at, like, oh, what was my max power and what stuff like this. But with road racing especially, it's like, it's almost like, how much did you conserve? Because it's really the people that can spend as little amount of energy possible and get to the end are the ones that are going to have that energy to go for a winning move or something like that. And so, like you said, if you're wasting all this energy yo-yoing off the back, then you're not going to be there at the end anyway.
Well, and it was really kind of a tragedy, like, from our team's perspective as well, because we had a guy who was going uphill so well. Like, I think, like, right before Gila, he did Flagstaff Super Flag in, like, top 10 all time. So he was moving so fast uphill, but he got dropped on every downhill section. And then our entire team had to come back and then drag him back in. But yeah, at that time, he was already working. So he did much, like, the results that he could have had compared to what he did because he wasn't comfortable descending was like, it was worth like a watt per kilogram, you know? Yeah. It was that significant. And it was such a bummer because it's like, man, if you could just stay in the pack, you would do so much better. But he wasted so much energy getting back in that it compromised. Yeah. It like neutralized his big talent. And, you know, that's, we're talking about, this is in road racing, but I was just listening to a recap of Leadville. And one interesting thing I heard in there was the women talking about where they were making time. And the women's winner, Sophia, I think she put a minute into the field, like coming back down one of the descents. And so it's just another thing, like, yeah, like it's all well and good if you can climb like a superstar, like that's great. And you're going to beat a lot of people, but the more competitive it is, like the more your performance is going to be a result of your collective skills. And don't think that if you have atrocious descending skills, if you're uncomfortable, that's not going to bite you, because you can, you can put it, like if you put a minute into somebody on a climb, that is a devastating advantage, but you can lose it.
Right.
You can cede more than a minute going downhill, which is crazy because you have to work so hard to gain that minute on somebody climbing. Like, take such fitness, such good fueling, such effort. And not that descending doesn't take some effort, but from an energetic perspective, I don't know. It's like, it's way less, you know. You could pull up a file and look, okay, you burned this many calories going up and you burned, you know, a fourth going back down, but you gained a minute spending a fourth less energy.
No. And it, like, I always think of it as free speed, and this is kind of a tangent somewhat, but there was an athlete that I started working with last November, I think, and she just did the Breck Epic this year. And when we first started working together, like, she's a super strong female. And so the thing I looked at was like, you know, like, maybe there's still potential there, right? Like, you can still get stronger, but the low hanging fruit was descending. And so her and I started riding together, and like, I plan on doing a case study on this, but it's like every time she rode, if you look at Strava, it was just like PRs and QOMs and stuff like that, just by descending. Right. And that's so much free speed. And so then all of a sudden she just did Breck Epic last week, and it's like, she's descending faster than the dudes. And she's like, you know, there's a guy on her tail, and she's like, do you want to pass? You're like, no, you're choosing great lines. And it's like, her FTP didn't change over the course of the year. And that was such, like, we focused on that in the winter when she was on the trainer, but once she got outside, it was just all about descending and riding off road. Right. And it's like, those are metrics that are kind of hard to quantify, but they come through in results. And it's like, yeah, didn't require any more energy. Like, it probably saved her energy for each stage, stuff like that. So you're right. It's like such a huge neglected thing when we're always focused on numbers, power, stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, just like the amount of information and, you know, call it publicity and clickbaity stuff about like, boost your FTP, or like, you need these numbers, da, 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 da. Very few people are emphasizing the impact of, hey, you know, you can go a lot faster using less energy if you can like rep these concepts. Like, you don't even have to be, you don't even have to be like world class or anything. Like, just take yourself from an F to a B minus.
Right.
Like, it's huge.
And it's totally huge. And so then your next race was Unbound, I think. And you're pleased with your result there. And so I'm curious, because with Unbound, I mean, there's usually not like big descents or anything like that. So like, what was it, or do you feel like there were some of the skills that carried over there and helped you this year in Unbound?
Absolutely. There weren't big descents, but there's definitely plenty of places where that were like really loose gravel, or sort of like you're moving fast and you're not really sure what's coming. And then what you realize the very last minute, what's coming is you're kind of going off or going through a rock garden.
Yeah.
Way faster than you thought. And you know, the first thing that you emphasized, like weight, like heavy feet, like let your front wheel do what it's going to do. That saved me so many times. And it was sort of surprising to me that my bike was okay through some of it, because I just like had the mantra and I was like, okay, do the mantra. And I did the mantra, and then I'm like, you know, I'm feeling and watching what my bike's doing, and I'm looking at the terrain thinking like, I'm going to die right now. And my bike was like, no, you're not.
These and bikes they're pretty capable. And it's like, I've ridden my gravel bike through some pretty gnarly shit. And so like, it amazes me what it's been able to handle, you know. And it's, I mean, we pay enough money for them, they should be pretty robust. It's like, just like trust your bike and, you know, let it do its thing.
Yeah, it was really remarkable. And also, I do think it actually also helped me in the mud a bit, because like the big thing with Unbound this year was the enormous like hell section of mud. to start off with. And I was actually able to ride a fair bit, just like kind of in the grass. And yeah, that was super solid. And I wouldn't have been able to do that the year before. Yeah. So yeah, that was nice. Big.
So is mountain bike next for you? You're going to hang up the gravel bike and transition?
I'm really tempted, to be honest.
It's way more fun, I promise you.
Yeah.
So moving beyond the skills piece, so you had a good result at Unbound. And it's, so just like, tell me, what was your result the last couple of years? You DNF'd the last couple of times, didn't you? Do I recall that correctly?
Unbound?
Yeah.
No, I never have.
Oh, okay.
I did it first in 21. That was Heatstroke City, but I pulled through. 22 was just, I overcooked myself going into it. And this year I really nailed it. So
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And so beyond the skill stuff, you also did Foco Fondo. I think you had a good result there, and you just did Steamboat. Was it last weekend? Seems like ages ago already, but you also had a good result there. I think, like, were you 20th there? Is that right?
I was 44th, which is okay. Pretty fast.
20th, 44th. It's all the same. And so beyond the skills, what other changes or what other things have you done this year that helped you improve your results over those last couple of races?
Two main things. Let's start with fueling. So you definitely have heard, but people listening have probably heard just sort of the evolution of taking down carbs and really trying to shoot for like 90 to 100 grams an hour, which is relatively new concept and is actually pretty disgusting and hard. 100 grams, that's the equivalent of, let's see, a gel is about 25. So it's like 4 gels an hour. And that sounds okay for an hour, but multiply that times an Unbound or even an SBT, like 7 hours, and you're staring at roughly 30 gels. So that's hard. And people think it's too much, but if you do the math and if you try it, it is like night and day difference for what you can sustain. And especially for gravel racing, so much of it is your ability to work just under your threshold for extremely long periods of time. And if you have the legs/endurance, then it, like, your bottleneck doesn't become as much like, are you going to get fatigued? Can your legs handle it? And more like, can you keep filling up your gas tank enough during this period to handle it? And there are some caveats in that, because you also need to figure out hydration, like get enough sodium so your small intestine can empty. But if you sort of figure out that balance well, and then also figure out like what combination of like solid food and liquid food you can take down, which I think is kind of an N=1 thing and something you need to practice in training, particularly long rides. But once you get that, you would not believe what your body can do deep, deep, deep into a race. Like, for example, at the end of SBT, there's what used to be the Steamboat Stage Race. So there's this corkscrew climb. Now, I have done that many times while the race was still going, and I had a certain time. And I noticed that this past time, as like last weekend on Strava, that I set my PR on it. The interesting thing about that is that I set my PR on this climb 6 hours deep,
right,
maybe 5,000 calories on a gravel bike. Every other time that I've raced it, it's been on a road bike. So it's just inherently slower. And I still beat that by 20 seconds, 6 hours deep at 95 degrees in a gravel race.
Yeah.
And the other time that I've raced it, I was maybe 3 hours deep on a road bike. But before I didn't know how to hydrate and fuel properly for it. So it's just, and I wasn't even, you know, going all out because I still had some race left.
Right.
And so to me, it's just like, thinking back on maybe all the performances I left like off the table, so to speak, because I just, maybe I was like too, I didn't want to, not that I didn't want to eat too much, but I like wasn't push. I was sort of not pushing the carbohydrate intake and the sodium as much as I could, because I didn't think I needed to, or I would only do it when I started to get hungry. And like all of those things from a fueling perspective are completely off. If you're hungry during a race, you're screwed. If you're starting to get thirsty during a race, you're screwed. Everything, like all of your sensations, like the moment you feel those sensations, it's like you're already 6 feet deep in your grave. You need to go in with a plan that you've practiced and refined, and then you need to execute it, because your subjective cues are out of line with your body's needs, because your work rate is too high for you to trust your subjective sensations, for the most part, I would argue. And so that's what I do. I just go in and I just hammer, man. Like, I've got my gels. I figured out this hack where I've got these little, you know, little cinnamon roll things, because they're cheap and they don't fall apart. And I put them in little packs, and I just go for it. And it feels gross, but I never, like, I just never got tired. I wouldn't say I never got tired. I never felt like energy was a limiter during SPT or Unbound. And so that has been a major shift for me. And I guarantee you that most athletes get this wrong, and they err on the less side for two primary reasons. One, they're afraid of eating too much because of weight and cycling. And two, it's hard for them to fathom what it actually looks like to do 100 grams an hour or 90 to 100 grams an hour.
And so as I hear you talking about this, and this is something I've worked on with my athletes, and I've tried to do it myself as well, I don't hear you paying too much attention to the glucose to fructose ratio. I'm guessing, like, as you're putting this together, you didn't like look at what the ingredients were for those little cinnamon rolls and think, okay, well, how does that pair with these gels? It sounds like you're just like shoveling food down your gullet. And
I mean, strategically, I think it would be hyperbole to say I'm shoveling it down. Like, I know, like, I get Precision Nutrition, the 90 gram. Mm-hmm. So I use those. So I know that, and I try to kind of alternate a bit. So I have like, usually I have like half to three quarters of one, and then I'll take two solid foods. Cause I found, because I've practiced and tried on long rides, if I just do the only gels, I start to feel shit after a while. But if I mix the solid and this, then my stomach seems to be fine and I can just keep on motoring. But that's me. Other people are successful taking down a lot with different regimes, but yeah,
it's because of practice. And I think that's such an important point, is that I have one athlete who's struggled the last several races with GI issues. And it's like, you know, we always emphasize practice, like train how you're going to race. And what I find, a lot of athletes don't do that, right? When they're out training, they're doing minimal and taking on like only food when they think they need it and stuff like that. And then you get into a race and you're trying to hammer the calories and your stomach just can't handle it. And like the stomach, just like every other muscle or every other part of your body, is highly adaptable. And so if you're going to try to push the calories, you need to do it in training to be able to do it in racing. The other thing is, I think, like you said, like it's N of one. And so finding out what works for you, and just because something works for somebody else doesn't mean it's going to work for you. And like really trying a bunch of different things and experimenting through trial and error to find out what you can stomach. The last thing is, I've got a couple of athletes that both do like 100 grams an hour. One of them does it primarily on gels, and he can handle that. Another one does like a highly concentrated, I think it's Heat or Hammer or something like that. And he's just got a water bottle and he puts marks on it. So he knows each notch is 100 grams. And so he just like takes a sip of that and then sucks down some water and takes, you know, so like every hour he's trying to do that. And so it's like just getting creative with it and trying different ways to be able to push that. And I do think people can get kind of too hung up on what that magic ratio is. And for the longest time, it was like 2-to-1 glucose to fructose, right? And then other studies came out. I think the original study said it was like 1-to-1, but that the ratio probably doesn't matter as much as you would think it does. And so it's really just like having multiple transportable carbohydrates is what the most important thing is with pushing over 60 grams per hour.
I agree. And I think another thing that really connected with me, I listened to something, Colby Pierce's podcast about his like nutritional prep for Unbound. And he had a great mantra, which is you need to show up to the line heavy.
Mm.
Meaning you need to, again, like weight is a big like taboo in cycling, and many cyclists, underfueling is a separate underfueling and training, that's a separate conversation, but you need to show up to the line with your glycogen stores full. Glycogen requires water for storage. You're going to be heavy, and people freak out about that. But the thing is, especially longer races, like off-road races, you're far better off having topped up glycogen stores and being a little heavier than you are showing up 4 pounds lighter, but very light glycogen stores. And I would even extend that to what I noticed in SPT is some people decided to run packs, like essentially like Usways or camel packs, and some people didn't. And there was a little bit of chat I saw about some people regretting that they had packs because it's the extra weight or not. And I just think that's nonsense. Like, you want to show up heavy, and you want to be able to take down as much as you can. You know, of course there are exceptions. You don't want to have a backpack full of groceries, but in general, like, you don't want to freak out about like the weight that your nutrition is going to cost you if it's allowing you to stay maximally hydrated and fueled for as long as possible. Because, and some of the reasoning was, well, if I didn't have this pack, that, you know, there's all these aid stations where I can stop. Well, the thing is, what ends up happening is you save like 2 pounds, good for you, but then you have to stop. Then you have to be more conservative in your fueling as you're going, because you have to make it different stops. And then eventually you will be forced to stop. And when you do, it's going to cost you probably at least a couple minutes, because you got to skid in, you've got to take off your bottles, got to fill them up, you got to grab food. And in that time, like, you're already kind of pushing it. You're taking some risks, because you have to decide to like let the group go or not. And so you're kind of like already a little bit on the edge, and then you're there and you're seeding more time, and then you've got to fill it in. And then you're going to have to put in an effort when you're already still, even if you replenish right there, you're going to have to put it in an effort, and you're already kind of like on the edge, and that can put people over. And why did this scenario happen? Because you were afraid to carry, you know, 2-3 pounds in your back, which you could have been sipping all along and just staying like comfortably above the red zone nutritionally and hydrationally. I think for those long stuff, you're not a weight weenie. Like, you should focus on staying maximally fueled. Like, you're not in the tour. The interesting thing with the tour, for example, or like a really, like a UCI race where you, like a Gila, where you get, there's caravans and support, is like, yeah, you can be a weight weenie then, because if you ever need anything, you just raise your hand and then you go back to the caravan and you get everything you want.
Right.
It's literally a supported ride. It's sort of supported because of the aid stations, but you still need to stop. And you know what's fast? You know what's really slow? Not moving.
Right. Well, so this is something I always tell my athletes. Again, like, everybody's concerned about being a little bit heavy, but like, even 3 pounds over a 100-mile race, it might be like 90 seconds, right? And that's assuming that you're always 3 pounds heavy. But like, as you mentioned, you start heavy, but you're drinking what's in your pack along the way. You're also depleting glycogen. You're also getting dehydrated. And so it's like, you might finish 5 to 10 pounds lighter than you started. Yes. And so not only that, but like you said, you're having to stop to fill up. often those first aid stations have tons of people at them. So you're also maybe standing in line trying to get to the water.
Yeah.
And then I also like the idea of a pack because I find that you just drink a lot more frequently. You don't have to take the hands off the bars to do it. So you're not like trying to grab a bottle, stuff like that. And was it last year that there was a big to do about, there was a group and two people had packs on and didn't want to stop. And one person didn't have a pack and got all pissed off because he stopped and lost a group. And it's like, that's racing, dude.
Yeah, so, that's racing, man.
I get all fired up about this because I just get so frustrated with this like marginal gain mindset. It's like, there's so many other things to worry about. Like again, descending, like if you can't descend with the group and you're yo-yoing off the back, who cares how much like extra water you're carrying, you know?
Yeah. And it should help you in that instance. It gives you a little bit of it.
Like yeah, exactly. Makes you heavier so you can stay with them.
Yeah.
Okay. So the last thing, you talked about this season, you learned about the panic pack. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Okay. So I have a general theory of gravel racing. If you visualize it as a play. So the first part is the introduction or the exposition, which just means in the first part of a race, insanity ensues. Everyone goes for their 20-minute PR best. It's insane. It doesn't matter how long the race is. Doesn't matter if it's 300. It doesn't matter if it's Unbound XL. Everyone goes crazy. You can't believe it. That ends up in groups. Second part, second act, is where every decision you've made energy-wise, nutritionally, everything else starts to play out. But there's a lagging, it's not a leading indicator yet. It's a lagging outcome of what is going to happen in the third part. You might feel good. You might be in a really good group and feeling great about yourself. You think, I'm going to have a great result. I'm going to win or just do better than I thought before. However, often what happens is the seeds of your own destruction are building under the surface. And then in the third act, everything that you've done in the previous two acts either bears fruit or there's death.
Right.
If you didn't eat enough, if you didn't hydrate enough, by the time you get to the third act, the parachute comes out, you explode, and you attack from the back. You go backwards super fast. Or if you've been racing smartly, hydrating, eating 90 grams an hour or more, you feel good or at least feel less bad. You can maintain a reasonable pace and you will pick off all of these people who didn't do the right things in the first two parts of the play. So with that, the panic pack is something that I've noticed because there's sort of a lesser known skill to start out in the first act of a play, which is, are you comfortable being around hundreds of people moving really fast into a narrowing course to get to the front? So you're not 250th wheel going into the actual race after neutral. I unfortunately am not. So unless it's a small intimate field, any of these monuments or big gravel races, I pretty much as a rule always go into the actual racing part super far back, well below, like mixed in with people who are well below my fitness level. Hmm. And so there's sort of two courses of action. You can panic or you can be chill and ride underneath your threshold and keep eating and drinking. Now, I call it the panic pack because other people also have this issue. They can't ball. They're not comfortable at the front, avoiding because they're afraid of crashing, which is fair, and all this other stuff. Setting that aside, different conversation. People in the panic pack make huge mistakes that compromise where they could be given their legs and fitness because they're panicking because they think they deserve to be in the front and they're not. And so they dump everything they have to get up there. And what quickly happens is they race the course like a dummy. By a dummy, I mean like, there's a sort of funny rhythm that happens in a gravel race where you will be in a group, right? you'd be in the panic pack of like 20 or 30 people. And there are some people who are just dumb strong. And you'd be going up these hills, and every hill that they do, they go maximal and they'll gap the pack. But you know what's after this small hill? A flat or a slight uphill or a slight downhill. And guess what? That person will either dangle for a while and then the group will just catch them. So that match that they burnt to put 10 seconds into the 30-person group going over the hill doesn't gain them anything. It makes them more tired. It demands higher energy and they get nowhere. There are instances in which that makes sense, but the only reason that you should ever do that is because you see another large group of people fairly close and bridgeable up ahead that you can latch onto. Because a pack going over anything but a long sustained climb is just going to be faster for less energy than you dangling off the front for no reason, you know, putting out threshold power for 40 minutes. I saw this with so many people in SBT, just super fit people taking flyers on every uphill, just crazy. You thinking they're like Jan Ulrich, just like, man, this guy's going up it at like so fast, with like 40 cadence. How does he do that? And they kept doing it for 100 miles, but the race is 140 miles. And then sure enough, what happened, Dave, is that we got to that, I'm not sure if you're familiar with SBT, but we got to the sort of like second half super long climb.
Mm-hmm. Is that Cow Creek or something?
Yeah, the Cow Creek or whatever climb. And I had done laughably little. Like all I had done was like take a respectable amount of poles, use like seg the climbs and just stick in with the group, just cruising. And then we got to the long climb. And then I was like, ah, like I felt legitimately good. I'm like, I feel great. I'm gonna take longer poles at the front. And so I went to the front, and all those people, maybe like five or six people who had been taking hero poles, all of a sudden it got really quiet. And I wasn't even like pinning it. I was just like, I'm going to go like under my threshold. I'm just going to go and, you know, keep a steady pace up this. And after about 5-10 minutes, I looked back and there was the two women who were in second and third behind me. And I was like, oh, I mean, the group was like 15 people.
Yeah.
Before. And then it was just like, just gone. And so the whole point is, if you find yourself in the panic pack, unless you're really close to the front, there is 0 point in you blowing all of your mashes on every uphill only to dangle in front of a group or try to make the front. Your best race is going to involve working in a large group, eating and drinking, conserving your energy, because people, because there's some of the opposite problem in the front group. Some people in the front group can ball way above their fitness. They're just good at handling. They love their adrenaline junkies. They're good. And so they get in the front group and they hang on, but they don't have the legs, and then they explode. And so, you know, if a front group is 30 people, 10 to 15 of them are riding above their head and they will explode. And what happens is in the third act of the play, you will pass them.
Right.
So you will never win this way, but what you won't do is start out in the panic group and then explode trying to get to the front group and then finish like way below where you should have because you raced like a dummy. There's the secret. There's the secret to.
Well, and I would say, like with any of these long races, it's always a battle of attrition, and everybody's a superstar in the first half, right?
Dave, I could not believe it. Like the energy and the power people were putting out was like truly.
and it can be hard because you think, at least I do a lot of the, like, it can be hard. And like, you think, oh, they must know something I don't, or, you know, it's hard to have that confidence and be like, I'm just going to like stick to my plan and I'll see you later in the race. Usually like 9 times out of 10. And like you said, like, it's a way more better place to be in mentally when you're reeling people in those last 40 miles than when you're riding backwards those last 40 miles.
God. Yeah. No, that's it's totally different experience.
Yeah. And I just want to like touch on one thing you said when you're talking about going up the long climb, and you mentioned several times riding under your threshold. And I just want to clarify, like, you're not sitting there staring down at your Garmin the whole time. You just know what threshold feels like, and you're paying attention Absolutely. To sensations in your legs and your breathing and things like that, knowing like, this is my red line. Above it, I'm going to blow up. Below it, it hurts, but I can do it for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, you, especially up there, like it's 3,500, 3,000 feet higher. So it wouldn't even be, and you know, 5 or 6 hours deep in the race. So it's not like I would know what my threshold is at that point. It's just right. a feeling like, oh, is this
exactly,
is this is like pretty sustainable for me or is it not? And if it's not, then you better be using your energy for a reason. Like, oh, we're about to crest the climb. The group is right there. I should punch it now so that I can latch on. But if it's like, there's one person, you know, a football field ahead of me, I'm not going to go red.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wanted to point that out. Like, I think it's such an important distinction and like a skill, a race skill that a lot of people maybe haven't developed yet. And it's just that feeling for, like you said, this sustainable, not sustainable. It's like continually checking in and like, you, like for longer races. And I mean, you weren't out there that long. So you were out there like 7 hours or so.
Yeah. Seven.
Yeah. So for people that are out there longer, it's like, there's going to be highs and lows, and you're going to have dark periods where it's like, you feel like you can't go on. And it's like, just constantly like checking in and like, what do I need now? Do I need more fuel? Do I need more hydration? Is this sustainable? Like taking advantage when you feel good, dialing it back when you're feeling bad. And just knowing that there's going to be a lot of it over a long day, I think is important.
Absolutely. All the data is neat. Having your power on your screen, your heart rate on your screen is neat, but the best scenario is just knowing yourself. Cause then you have interoception. You can check in on your internal state. You won't know how to interpret it if you never do it though. So just like being able to feel like, oh, that was a little rough, I better back it off, versus like, I have no idea, I need to keep this power number on my screen. Like, you're not a robot.
Yeah.
Your body, like the way you feel inside is your body's expression of all of the stress that you're taking in at once. Your power meter is only expressing how hard and how fast you're pushing pedals. It says nothing about the heat or the wind or your nutritional status or your hydration status or how long you've ridden. It doesn't know any of that. It's just like, it's just a measurement. So yeah. Yeah. People, that's the best way to, like, you need to have an internal sense as you race, especially in gravel and long stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Well, thank you very much for your time. Any parting words of wisdom before I let you go?
Show up to the line heavy, like a fat kid.
And I just want to, and maybe I'll add this to the, like the infographic, but like Oscar Eukendroop has put out a thing a couple of times, and it like basically you can gain like 3 to 4 pounds with glycogen, because for every gram of glycogen there's 3 grams of water, like you had said, you know. And it's like, I notice it, I don't know if you notice it, but like after a big weekend of training I might gain weight on Monday and Tuesday.
Yeah.
And for me that's just telling me my body, like, I'm replenishing glycogen. And so it's like, like you said, it can be very tempting to like, oh, I shouldn't eat today, or I shouldn't do these things, because you don't want to gain weight as a cyclist. But ultimately we're trying to fuel the work we're doing, and showing up heavy is a great way to do that.
Yeah. And like you can, it's pretty easy to run the math, like the difference between you having the glycogen to even run at like tempo deep into a race versus you not being able to touch the bottom of zone one pinned at threshold heart rate is a major speed difference. Like, wait, I don't care if you're 10 pounds lighter there, you're still going slow as shit.
Yeah.
So don't hold back, you know?
Yeah. And this is something I forgot to mention too, when we were talking about the nutrition thing, I think this is something I've like thought about a lot. And I think what's interesting, and I still haven't cracked the code or like found good information, but for somebody like you, I mean, you've got like a 400 watt FTP, right? Like you're a pretty strong guy. And so you're burning a lot more kilojoules per hour than somebody who's got a 220 watt FTP. And so I think that's the other.
Dave, I did the math on this too.
Did you? Yeah. So like, I've always wondered, like, does it make sense for somebody who's burning 500 calories per hour to try to push 100 grams per hour or consume 100 grams per hour? And I know that there could still be more, that performance benefit, but it's like a lot of times, like, are you overfueling? And that's a question I haven't been able to answer yet.
I think so. I mean, it does depend on your like fat burning ability, but like just to run the numbers on mine. So I assumed that at the intensity I was going, so I averaged 236 for 7 hours. And so that's almost 6,000 calories. And I assumed that I was roughly burning five calories from fat every minute. So that translates out to during that ride, I burned 234 grams of fat and used 961 grams of glucose or carbohydrate over 7 hours. So those are big numbers, but the long and the short of it is, even at eating 90 grams an hour, I'm still falling behind by about 40 to 50 grams of carbohydrates.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, I think it's something to like take into consideration, and also how hard you're racing. So somebody who's racing a 12-hour race and is riding primarily at like zone two, you're probably not burning through carbohydrate quite as fast as somebody who's racing tempo for 7 hours.
True. But it's still like, even if you break down, you're right. Like it depends on how, like your functional threshold, like what your zone two wattage cracks out to. But I would think as a general rule of thumb, even at zone two, you're probably burning far more carbohydrates than you think you are. And thus tapping yourself out, and then performance is going to drop. So most people that I've observed and worked with under fuel and thus compromise their training, their recovery, and then over time their performance simply because they're underestimating their body's need for carbohydrates. And going into like, just really touching on, I think like, well, what about fat adaptation and like low carb?
Nope. Cutting that out. Kidding.
The greatest takeaway I can do with that is your ability to burn fat is mostly driven by your training intensity, your volume at training intensity. And if you can eat lots of carbohydrates, but you're going to be burning or using most of your energy from fat if you ride at the right intensity, which isn't weekend warrior pace. It's easier than you think it is. So that's number one. And then number two, and this is kind of a Cousins thing, but I think it's really valid, is using what I call the switch, meaning if you're training, eat carbohydrates, use them. If you're sitting on the couch, maybe don't pound the family size bag of M&Ms. If you just do those two things, if you do your endurance training at the right intensity, like which is probably easier than you're doing it, and then don't pound sugar when you're not training, that's really going to help your ability to burn fat.
Yeah. And ultimately, and this turned into a nutrition podcast, but ultimately we want to be flex fuel engines and not only good at burning carbohydrate or only good at burning fat. We want to be able to use both those things equally.
Yes.
When the demands rely on it, basically. So,
and that's the problem with the low carb bacon worshipers. if you really want to go fast, you're going to need some carbohydrates. I guess if you're racing across America, maybe you can fuel it on bacon alone. But if you ever want to go like close to or above your threshold, you're going to need some glucose.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So where can, remind us where we can find you?
Gravelgodcycling.com.
And how about the social medias?
I am on it. I'm not a big poster though. Newsletter's pretty fun. My newsletter is pretty fun. If you go to my website, I have an annoying pop-up, but I promise you the stories I write are different than you'll see. I'm trying to keep the long form alive. Awesome. And I know it'll go viral, but it is cool.
I think it's appreciated, and it's a dying art. So keep up the God's work there.
Thanks.
All right, man. Thanks for your time.
You bet.